Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Okay, let me explain it another way. Do you believe that things can happen that are beyond our capacity to rationalize because we have this very limited temporal view of reality?
I guess, yeah.
Does A&E's Waco, Madman, or Messiah fail to answer the question of why David Koresh couldn't be both? And does Paramount's big-name-studded Waco fail at pretty much everything? Two takes on the Branch Davidian tragedy, plus a vintage behind-the-scenes look at charismatic preaching in Marjo. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 42. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, Previously.tv's take on all things true crime on TV. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined once again by Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back on, because we are cutting through the high weeds of a whole lot of Waco material that's coming out in the sort of run-up to the anniversary of the beginning of the siege in Waco, Texas. I really can't believe that was a quarter century ago. It's making me feel old. But let's get into it. We have two things going on in our most wanted section this week. We are talking about both A&E's Waco, Madman, or Messiah, which is a two-night documentary event. It has aired now, as you're listening to this, in its entirety. We're also talking about Waco, which is more of the recreation slash fictionalization starring Riggins from Friday Night Lights, which I'm really going to struggle not to call him that. We'll get into that. Let's start with the documentary version. Here's the case synopsis, which I tried to boil down so it only took up like a quarter of a screen. Between February 28th and April 19th, 1993, the Branch Davidians, a sect separated from the Seventh-day Adventists and led by, quote, Prophet David Koresh, born Vernon Howell, were besieged by the ATF and FBI as a result of weapons violations that led to a search-slash-arrest warrant. In the attempt to serve this warrant and raid the ranch, a gun battle erupted, killing four government agents and six Branch Davidians. A siege was then initiated by the FBI, lasting 51 days and culminating in a tear gas attack. A fire broke out at this point that engulfed the compound. 76 people perished, including Koresh. I think this is just like the tip of the iceberg of this story. So I was glad that this documentary took its time with the lead up and setting the scene, because I don't know the case well and I don't remember it all that well, except for the horrible TV movie starring Tim Daly as David Koresh. Toby, how familiar were you with this case prior to like all the reimaginings that have started coming out of late?
So when I was getting my master's degree like 18 years ago, I took a class in cults and charisma, which was basically taking a look at new religions and why, you know, some succeed, some fail. And so one of the things that we studied was David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. So, you know, from what I can remember from 18 years ago, I was fairly well versed, I guess, enough to kind of know what they left out in the documentary, which was some of the kind of juiciest stuff.
Okay. I'm going to count on you to leap in if I'm glossing over anything, because I tend to pull these things apart as entertainment versus accurate history.
Right.
But you mentioned, I think I got the correct clip, but you mentioned, like a piece of, they have all these tapes that they use, some of which they say have never been heard before, of the phone conversations between Koresh and various, hostage negotiators during the siege. You mentioned this clip. I think I got the right one. So let's hear clip two.
You don't understand my doctrine. You don't want to hear the word of my God.
For God's sake, David, are you going to come out?
I shouldn't have chuckled at that, but there's something about the whininess of Koresh there. He's like, you just don't get it. You know, forget you, Dad. And then the FBI is like, fuck's sake, just come out.
Right.
Like, are you coming out or not? Did I get the right clip? And if so, how does that kind of encapsulate the whole, like this whole tragedy?
Well, yeah, that was the right clip. And I think, and again, I don't want to get too into the weeds with, you know, what happened, sort of the academia stuff around it, because we're mostly just talking about it as a show. But, you know, one of the big mistakes that I think was when people pointed at the FBI and how it was handled was, you know, the Branch Davidians were into some really weird sort of religious stuff. And that was the way Koresh and his followers kind of viewed the world, right? And a lot of it was Book of Revelations. So when you're dealing with them, you should keep that in mind. So setting up a situation which, from the inside of that commune, is kind of look like the Book of Revelations, with, you know, the government closing in and, you know, blasting music, and then there's fire and all this stuff, that sort of being more aware of how they're going to be viewing your actions, I think has generally been pointed to as one of the big problems that sort of led to the final tragedy.
Yeah, that was definitely a sense that I was getting as the documentary wore on, was that. And there's another clip to this effect as well. Like, if this is a, like, doomsday cult is a little bit, like, it doesn't really get its arms around it. But if part of what he spends a lot of time on is the coming apocalypse and the second coming and the opening of the seven seals and the end of days, then if you're threatening them with death, or sort of presenting it as this binary thing, like, come out or you're all going to be killed, what is his motivation to sell that to everyone in the compound, when what he's been saying all along is, like, we are chosen and we will, you know, we will be assumed. I assume, like, I don't know exactly what he was telling them in there, but threatening this particular set of beliefs with like mortal death is not going to get the job done.
And I think it, you know, I can't, you know, I watched them back to back. So I'm trying to remember which was where it showed up in, but essentially it's also just confirming what he's sort of preaching about and, you know, quote unquote prophesizing is, you know, the government's going to come, you know, it's the beast, it's Babylon. And so when they do show up, it just sort of confirms his authority to those people. So, yeah, it's not a good dynamic.
I mean, yeah, I did, as an undergrad, I did a pretty long research paper on the Book of Revelation, and we'll get into how kind of crazy this book is a little later, but there's all kinds of little details in it. The one I love pointing to is, like, after the seventh seal is broken, silence reigned in heaven for about half an hour. Like, okay, cool. Why not 45 minutes? Why not a multiple of seven? That just seemed, I mean, maybe it was 28 minutes, but it's very interesting that that's how it's translated. And that was the length of time. And Revelation is full of that stuff. I went to a pretty hippy dippy church, but I have a little trouble relating to like Christian rock as part of the liturgy, I guess. So when we're hearing from survivors, it's definitely interesting to hear them talk and to feel like some of them still might feel that this was a lost Eden,
right,
on this compound. But in clip three, we're going to hear some of the songsmithery of David Koresh. Here we go.
I loved when David played music. That was like It was like the best thing to go to church and listen to.
Riding on white horses, fearing the night.
David's music became a part of the teaching, became a part of what he did on a daily basis. He taught us we were part of something bigger than us.
Koresh made audio tapes of sermons he had given, and people passed them on to each other.
Like he's fish.
Right.
I mean, but there is something about, that too, that he can sort of leverage that and be like, you know, outside people won't understand what this is about, which I think generally is a very effective technique of, for instance, Scientology, that it just puts you in opposition to the outside world and makes you feel like the cult are the only people that understand what's really going on, sheeple. So, but I just thought that was interesting that they were like trading tapes like he's the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, the whole music thing I think is also kind of interesting because, you know, his sort of, I guess it seems like kind of the formula he eventually ended up on was sort of these marathon sessions of like him sort of lecturing and hectoring people and then playing music and then back to lecturing and hectoring people. And then if you had to go to the bathroom, well, that was too bad. which is just like, it's the same, like, I don't know if there's like a playbook somewhere or something, but it seems like cult after cult after cult. It's like, this is how they do it. You know, Jim Jones did the same thing. It's like these, like,
I was just going to mention
hours and hours and hours. And then, you know, music is just is a huge part of a lot of charismatic, you know, Christian, you know, like sort of more mainstream sects like Pentecostals and stuff, but also, some of the weirder stuff as well.
Yeah. And I think, many religious traditions, aside, you know, entirely outside of churches, like the whole, you know, anything that has an ecstatic tradition.
Right. Have you seen
music is a part of that. Drums is a part of that.
Have you seen, was it the Divine Horseman of Haiti?
No.
It's this crazy, it's a documentary by, I think her name is Maya Duran. I'm sure I'm getting this slightly wrong, but anyway, she is a woman documentarian, and I think it's in the 50s. It's in black and white, but she's in Haiti at these sort of, you know, voodoo ceremonies, and it's all this drumming and people sort of dancing and getting into these crazy trance states, and it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, this is going to be a ridiculous reference, or it's going to sound like it is. Because it is, but the segment of In Search Of on the voodoo tradition and the role that the ceremony itself plays in people's connection to the religion was actually pretty good. Huh. Like, In Search Of could be really stupid, and they put some crazy outfits on Leonard Nimoy, but, you know, occasionally you'll learn something.
Right. Yeah, I was an aficionado.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was an aficionado of that back in the day.
Yeah, I did a rewatch of the entire series.
Really?
Which you can find on previously.tv. Yeah, that it was some roof stoof at the end there. But they were pretty good. They were obsessed with the Mayans, yep. Which after six seasons, you're like, okay. But there's definitely an element of well, I guess Bacchanal, but like the experience, like experiencing it as a group and the psychological, like the crowd contagion effect, which we'll get into in a later segment.
Sure.
I'm going to play clip four, and then I'm interested to hear what you think about, like, whether you think Koresh was sincere in some of his, justifications. Or if you think he was just a, you know, self-justifying charlatan. Let's hear clip four real quick.
I said, how do you pronounce that last name? Shots are being fired. People are screaming in the background. And he very calmly says, Agent Sage, have you ever heard a person die? It's like that last exhalation of breath. It's Koresh.
I think there is an argument to be made that he was suffering from some kind of mood or personality disorder, but I don't think so. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. I think he had a very strong sense of his own brand, as alien as it might be to normies like ourselves.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a couple things that go on, and one of which is, you know, that within, you know, this very small sect that has sort of, you know, obsesses over these certain aspects of the Bible, that his ability to like sort of both memorize it and then be able to kind of interpret it in a way that people find sort of compelling and sort of makes sense to them. You know, within that group, I think, you know, that's such a valued talent to have that I think it sort of gives him more sort of social and sort of probably egotistical status than you would expect from something that seems like not necessarily trivial, but sort of beside the main point of life, I guess. So I think there's that, but then there's also, you know, it always comes down to sex, you know, it's like all these guys like get to a certain point and then it's like, well, I'm going to have to start sleeping with a whole bunch of women. And it sort of ends up that way with him, which is when you start to think, you know, how much is he, how sincere is that aspect of it?
Well, right. That, I mean, we have a clip about that, but you know, there are parts of this that I was like, is he crazy or is he crazy like a fox? There was a local reporter that they quoted at some length who was kind of my favorite thing about this documentary. Starting with this quote in clip 5.
When I read the book of Revelation, I say, oh, the guy who wrote it was on acid. First acid work. When you get to interpreting people riding horses of different colors with spears and arrows and monsters around them, this is a big job. But David Koresh claimed he could make sense of it.
That was Dick Rivas of the Dallas Observer, and that goes to what you were just talking about, that this is a good skill to have, at least in turn, even if you think it's bullshit artistry, there is an artistry to it, I suppose. But it, yeah, while this is going on, they're showing this like cartoon.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I know. Is this an actual cartoon that we can like get, like that we can watch? Because the lamb with the seven eyes and whatnot, I was like, okay, like someone animated the book of Revelation. I will watch that.
Yeah. I think it must be like from like some kind of like 70s or 80s video, like probably for, you know, middle school kids to show them how cool the Bible is.
They put it on right after Davy and Goliath on Sunday.
Yeah. Night. Yeah. It's like you go from Davy and Goliath to VeggieTales to like the adventures of the book of Revelation or something.
I do feel like you could get a full season out of that. But at the same time, I mean, you know, there's only so long that you can do this, and then you really have to start, digging for legit justifications. Like, I didn't clip anything about this, but he comes into this Branch Davidian compound or like, you know, community, which it's not named after him. It already existed.
And yeah. I mean, it goes back to like the '50s, and, yeah. And it's just a brand, like when it's a Seventh-day Adventist church and it split. And then they were, the Davidian was like one sort of Seventh-day Adventist sect. And then that split. And then that's, so they're the Branch Davidians, and there's like another group of Davidians, I guess.
Yeah. So I think the original leader of that particular split off subsect died, and his widow was in charge, and she was like 70. And then Koresh, who was still going by Vernon Howell at that time, comes in and begins a sexual relationship with her. And then all of a sudden he's in charge. And there was a big battle. If you Google this woman's son,
yes,
and like the battle for control of this sect between him and David Koresh, it's, I mean, this was a, you know, nasty, brutish and short life.
But including that, like, so the son challenged David Koresh, I guess then Vernon Howell, to a contest to see who could raise the dead.
Yeah.
Right. So, and so
it was not a recent departure.
No.
They dug up for this contest either. She'd been in the ground for a couple months already. And then he was arrested for interfering, quote unquote, with a corpse, which I'm not sure that's exactly what that means in the law.
But it's like, yeah, great that Koresh was just like, you know, he didn't even bother. He just like let him dig the stuff up and then was just trying to figure out a way that he could, you know, turn him into the police for some kind of violation. And that's what they came up with.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And I mean, again, the son definitely needed the intervention of professionals. Not that it ended up helping him much.
But the idea that would be like, just, I think that kind of just shows how far out the people you're talking to are, because I mean, not the people you're talking to, but the people who are in that congregation are, that even if they're, you know, not fully invested in it, the idea that somebody who's in the midst of it would think that maybe this is a good idea. Like,
yeah,
maybe this will really rally the
troops. This contest, like, never mind picking a side, pick the side of sanity, go to the road, flag down a car, right, go to the nearest city and don't look behind you ever.
Like that one woman did, and she left her kids behind and she was just like, took, yeah, off.
Oh God. That was really sad. Yeah. I thought the inclusion of the survivors and also of, Howell's family was really good. His childhood was, you know, disastrous in pretty much the ways that you would expect. His half brother is like, oh yeah, my dad treated him like shit.
Right.
Like, didn't seem real surprised that it turned out this way. And the survivors relate certain, the demise of a certain Dolly is related, like, well, that's just how it was. That was just the rules. Clip six.
My mom had bought me this Wetsy Betsy doll. And when she drank water, she peed. You can see the privates. David saw it and told me to shoot it because it was not proper.
I mean, I just get the sense this is the same woman who was talking about loving David's music.
Yeah.
I just get the sense that, like, she understands that she's not supposed to think this is true anymore, but that a part of her maybe still does. Like, I think a part of her is still attached to that community for whatever reason, whether it's post-trauma, sincerely missing the good parts of it. I don't know, but.
Well, I think it's hard to change your, I mean, it's gotta be like culture shock, right? I mean, she comes from, yeah, living in this little compound and like basically having a very restricted sort of set of things that she can do and just constantly getting this Koreshian sort of religion thrown at her. And then when it all ends and like, I assume like almost everyone she knows dies, it's like, where do you, how do you pick up from that?
Yeah. And this documentary, we'll talk about this a little more in the next segment, but I found myself wondering whether there was not pressure, but like what the discussions were within the production about where to come down on who is responsible for what occurred. We're really only talking about part one right now, but maybe that's something they get into more in part two. But certainly one guy who left is commenting here in voiceover about, you know, as the walls were kind of closing in because of the weapons violations, and also that I think Child Services had come out to the compound at that point and had been told, like, okay, like, yeah, his wives, some of them are 14 or 15, but parental permission was given, which I guess in Texas was, that was allowed. So nothing had really happened, but Koresh must have known that once that got out to the outside world, that was going to be what brought the hammer down. That a lot of people aren't necessarily going to care that you're like making grenades on your own compound, but if you're fucking a 14-year-old, the law's going to come. Like, people are going to raise a stink. So here's Mark Brault talking about what he thinks might have motivated or catalyzed the end in clip 7.
So David was under a lot of pressure, because if you're specially chosen by God, you can never be wrong. He thought he was moving toward the end time. But as life pretty much continued, there was a little bit of disquiet, so he had to start to make things happen. He had to make the apocalypse happen.
Thoughts? I mean, it's just what we've been saying pretty much this whole time, that it's like, well, maybe he sincerely believed this was coming down, but as the leader of this sect, he's got to sell it.
Right. And I think that's, you know, I think you can be sincere in sort of your beliefs, but also understand that in order to kind of maintain sort of, you know, a heightened sense of religiosity amongst the people who are following you, that you have to sort of create these situations that are kind of galvanizing. And that, you know, the idea that you're living like the end times could be happening like tomorrow or like in a month or something, and like that's the way you live, is got to be like, you know, pretty different. The only thing I can think of to compare it to is like waiting for like a baby to be born or something, where it's just like, it could happen in an hour, it could happen tomorrow. And so I think there is, you know, you have to kind of find ways to keep, you know, keep people at that sort of fever pitch level. You know, and then I also, you know, it's always hard to have, like, when you're doing something like this, it's like, who can you interview? And it really comes down to, you either interview people who are still kind of buy into it, you know, so they're given one side, but then apostates are always, you know, there's a reason why they left, right? So there, it's not like he's like coming at it from a completely dispassionate place, you know?
This particular guy for sure.
Yeah.
But there are also, this is an interesting situation, because some people did get out of the fire, so they didn't leave the compound because, like, it wasn't apostate. They weren't apostates. They left because it burned down and the FBI came in to get the survivors. So, I mean,
yeah. So there's the Australian guy, and there's a guy with a beard, and then the two women who seem to have very different reflections on their experience, where one was like, oh yeah, it wasn't so hard to leave my husband. You know, I was sleeping with God. And then the other one clearly, you know, found it traumatic, as you would imagine.
Yeah. Well, and that's sort of, I mean, what you were just saying about sort of a leader of this kind of sect having to, you know, your religiosity could be sincere, but there's also this need to galvanize and to keep belief at a certain pitch. And I think over time for these leaders, sometimes it curdles and then the proportions change. Like Jim Jones, I feel like it turned a lot earlier than they're even moving to Guyana.
Right.
Koresh, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about it to say, but when he starts in with the new light thing, which basically is like, we have to repopulate this compound with
my kids,
you know, yeah, as instructed by Revelation. And guess what? Like, all y'all men are going to be celibate and, like, you know, hand over your wives, basically. which not everyone was thrilled with, but it's one of those like turning up the temperature under the frog
right.
things where a lot of them were just like, well, we'll see. But certainly Revis is not buying it in clip 8.
David concludes, perhaps conveniently, that he had to be the father of those 24 elders. The problem with that is the elders were born of virgins. Pretty hard to find a virgin in Waco, Texas, or anywhere else these days. And perhaps that is why he slept with some women who were underage.
He does have a certain way of understating things,
right.
Mr. Revis. Yeah, this is where, you know, I sort of was like, is this really a crime story for this podcast? But, you know, I think they were committing various weapons amassing crimes, and certainly, at least morally, the sleeping with 14-year-olds was perhaps evidence of delusional thinking. Perhaps.
Well, it definitely got, you know, law enforcement.
Sexist pedophilia.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it qualifies.
Yeah, but I mean, overall, I thought that this did an excellent job. Like, I think Koresh is, it's easy to make him a figure of fun or to turn him into this cartoon, like the mullet and the glasses and the outre religiosity, let's say. I think is easy to caricature even in a documentary project. And I think, again, only speaking about the first half, I think this one did quite a good job getting a lot of information in, presenting it in a way that continued to be visually interesting, and I would definitely recommend to keep watching it. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I thought it was, and I actually, the title, like David Koresh, Messiah or Madman, like threw up all these red flags.
Yeah.
But then they don't really, you know, that doesn't seem to be sort of the lens that they view it through, thankfully. So, yeah, I thought it was, you know, pretty good. It does. It did a couple of things that kind of drive me insane about all documentaries, with like mixing like footage that they take with actors in with like actual footage that was filmed of the Branch Davidians back in the day. And it's not always entirely clear. I mean, I think if you're paying attention, you can probably just tell the difference by the quality of the pictures, but because you're not introduced to all the people, like there's sometimes it's like, wait, is this actually going on? And you're like, no, they probably did not like film that baby being blown to pieces by a machine gun. The baby doll. What is
God.
It? Weddy Betty or whatever her name is.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I thought it was really good. Thumbs up.
Yeah. Yeah. There's been a lot of, I feel like all the network news mags have had a take on it in the last month or so, most of which I skipped. But A&E is definitely trying to raise the game in terms of like historical, like documentaries of history, and which makes sense since that's their sister network. And I thought this was good. And it, again, that seems like a pretty fine line, given who Koresh was, how he looked, and what became of him and what he did. It would be easy to blunder into cartoonishness, and they don't.
Except for that one cartoon, which is great.
Well, yeah, except for the literal cartoon of Revelation, which please to tell us how we can find that. You can hit us on social media. Facebook and Twitter is at Blotter Presents. We would love to hear all about that. You can also let us know in the forums. Previously.tv/forums. Unfortunately, we weren't so lucky with the cartoonishness in the second part of our most wanted section. I'll skip the case synopsis because same thing. The only difference here is this is a 6-part miniseries, not fictionalized, but, you know, TV movie style. This is Paramount's big like coming out party as they rebrand from Spike TV. And you've got some heavy hitters in it. Taylor Kitsch is David Koresh. Paul Sparks from House of Cards is his right-hand man, Steve Schneider. Rory Culkin and Rory Culkin's execrable wig is in it. Andrea Riseborough, who actually just killed a baby on Black Mirror, spoiler, is also in it. Her wig's even worse. John Leguizamo is the undercover FBI agent. I really had quite high hopes for this. Did you? I know that we were both disappointed. Did you think this was going to be better than it was, or is this about what you expected it was going to be?
I didn't know. I mean, I think it's a, I don't think it's too hard to make a good show about this, but I think the temptations for making a crappy one are pretty high. So I guess I had, my expectations were certainly higher than what we got, which is not to say they were super high, but the idea that some of these people would be attached to this project just seems to me insane. And then the lead.
Well, you mentioned specifically that you didn't, I forget your exact phrasing, but forgive me if I'm misquoting you. I think it was something along the lines of whoever thought Taylor Kitsch should be a good fit for this is a moron. Would you say that reflects your views?
Yeah. it's such a strange, like Taylor Kitsch is like like very good looking, regardless of how you do his hair and how much weight he loses, which David Koresh didn't really appear to be. So it's like kind of a different charisma he has. And then he's also, he just seems like he's such a super normal actor, you know? It's like having him play somebody with like sort of intense pathos just seems sort of misjudged in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know if you were a True Detective watcher or if you sort of how you felt about season two. Wise move. Don't go there now. But I thought his casting worked in that because he could be so interior that it almost worked, especially in that season because the writing was so shitty that it was like, let's just have somebody who's not like doing a whole lot on screen.
Right.
But casting him, like there's a sort of superficial resemblance to Koresh. But this is someone who's personal and spiritual and like liturgical charisma was formidable. And Kitsch is trying, but it's just not quite right. I feel like maybe he and Sparks should have reversed roles because Sparks has that like nervous, weird thing where he's not that attractive, but you look at him anyway.
Yeah.
Like, well, I'll play clip 9, but you could sort of see how it's not quite going to work.
Steve, professor of theology. Amazing. You lived with your wife, Judy, in paradise on the beach in Hawaii. Enough?
Not even close.
Not even close. See, that's the big trick. It's never enough, no matter what you do. So how is it a man can find joy here? I'll tell you. Joy doesn't come from having something or being something. It comes from becoming. Becoming more than you are today.
I mean, it just misses, and then it misses by a mile as a result. Like it doesn't quite work. And that soundtrack cue in the background sounds really a lot like Friday Night Lights. Like, don't do that show.
Yeah. You know, while I was watching, I was like, is he just like focusing so hard on getting the accent right that like he really can't do much else?
But he was on a show where he was in Texas. Like that can't be.
Oh, you know, I've never watched Friday Night Lights, so I don't know any of that stuff. But he, you know, he kind of comes off as a sort of like happy-go-lucky guy, and especially after hearing in the documentary, like some of Koresh's ranting, You know, I mean, he was like genuinely kind of scary, I would imagine. And maybe that comes up later in the miniseries. Like, I'm sure they'll have some kind of character arc where he gets darker and darker and darker. But yeah, he just doesn't seem like a very formidable person. Did you see Mary, Marcy, Marlene, or whatever that was called?
Yes, I did.
So that was, I thought it was John Hawkes. Is that the name of the actor?
Yes.
Yeah. So he would have been really good in this. Like I would have paid him whatever to take that role. Because I think he does in a completely different kind of setting and stuff, but he has that same kind of weird sort of charisma and intensity and sort of, you know, a little bit of malevolence that would have made it, would have been perfect. But,
Or, the guy who played, no one else watched Aquarius but me, but the guy they had playing, Manson, who was like the only like fictional, like acted Manson I've really ever been able to stand, including fucking actual Manson,
right?
Fuck off, Charles Manson. But he, Gethin Anthony, I think his name is, he's an Australian. Like both these actors are maybe a little too short, but like, I don't know, put him in some cowboy boots, work with the camera angles. But yeah, this is not quite, it's just not quite right. And on top of that, I mean, this is one of the smaller problems with this, I feel, which is that I feel like there are certain parts of the story that are pretty well known and other parts that aren't well known, but this started to feel with some of the exposition, whether it, characters in the compound or outside. And granted, some of it is like, this is based on two books and one of the characters is like, you know, one of the authors of one of the books. And it's like, okay, I guess you feel an obligation to the material, but I like, this just feels checklisty and like kind of like a book report. Like you're just trying to get everything in so you can justify buying the rights.
Yeah.
And it's not interesting. Like somehow it's like more information, but less informative than the documentary.
It's just super clumsy, I think. Like the part where I wasn't paying so much attention to it, but there's a point at which, you know, Rory Culkin's character, whose name is Tebow, I think, is like talking to this, you know, this girl he's kind of got his eye on. And she's like, you know, sure have liked having you here the last 6 months. And it's like, okay, so time's passed. It's 6 months since the last scene. You know, it's just clumsy.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, and here's Andrea Riseborough. Well, I don't know. Or as I have in my notes, Wallace Simpson and Mickey Cohen having a discussion about the fact that they're married to each other. And I think this is the woman that you were talking about in our previous segment who was like, I didn't so much mind giving up my husband. I just felt bad for him. I think this is the character based on her. Anyway. Right.
And she has the opposite reaction.
What's going on, yeah. Steve?
You know what's going on? You don't know how hard this has been for me. Trying to have a baby for 10 years, and now you got Dave's child. Too much. Maybe I didn't think this through. Maybe it was a mistake to go along with David's new light revelation. Maybe we should have left like Mark and Elizabeth.
If you didn't like it, why did you accept it?
I just thought, well, if your wife has a chance to marry the Lamb of God, who am I to hold her back, right?
Steve.
No, I don't want to talk to you. I need some time to think.
Okay, yeoman exposition cramming there, Sparksy, but what's with the Fargo accent?
I know. This is the whole thing is kind of weird. And then the whole, you know, so in this one, there's a point at which she says, you know, I wanted you or something, you know, and in the documentary, like the real woman was like, oh no, it was awesome. You know, I was married to God, you know, who wouldn't want to do that? So it was, you know, it seemed like another way in which they're sort of, you know, you got to do this, but they're kind of they're kind of setting up little sort of soap opera drama stuff where it would have been more interesting to have it the way that, according to the documentary, it actually was, in that she's actually kind of psyched about it, instead of being...
Yeah, like she's cringing a little in retrospect, right. But she's also like, you know, and on top of that, this guy is not available to say one way or the other his side of it. So, because he was killed, I think, he was one of the Davidians killed
right.
The first day. So, I mean, but then later in the first episode, by the way, this airs on Wednesdays on the Paramount Network. At, I think, 10 p.m. So there's another episode airing tonight. I'm probably not going to be watching it because of clips like number 11.
The Ruby Ridge report, I have some concerns.
Mm-hmm.
It says that Mitch acted appropriately.
Well, in all fairness, he wasn't trying to kill Vicki Weaver.
No, but he did break the rules of engagement in the field. He should be facing an investigation, not getting a pat on the back.
This mess belongs to the ATF. Look, the boys upstairs are worried that if we reprimand Mitch, then we're admitting fault.
But we are at fault. He issued a kill-on-site command, and a woman was killed.
Okay, that's Michael Shannon of Boardwalk Empire referring to Shea Whigham of Boardwalk Empire. Also, Paul Sparks, like, nice workfare program. But this is the issue with this project to me is, well, first of all, the exposition is very clumsy. Second of all, they're spending quite a bit of time on Ruby Ridge. I know you can't necessarily separate them, but it felt just too long. And it also felt a little bit like pandering to anti-government types. It's like, oh no, we get it. The government fucked up. Like, yeah, but you can't have it both ways. Like, I think you have to pick a side in this story, and I don't love that. I just don't love this particular, like, panopticon of viewpoints that they're trying to do so as not to offend anyone.
Right. Yeah, the whole Ruby Ridge thing, like, I get why you needed to do it, and it was funny to see a guy playing Bo Greitz, who was sort of malevolent but amusing character back then. It's a little frustrating because I think it sort of sets up this too easy tension between, like, the guy who just wants to set up a bunch of snipers and take people out versus the guy who wants to talk and have it all be done peacefully. And it's like, well, of course you're going to root for this guy. You know,
well, and Michael Shannon, again, like, wrote the book. He wrote, like, a book just about being an FBI hostage negotiator generally. This part of the, like, I assume that part of it, this is taken in part from that book. So that's that character, or, you know, that was a real person. So it's a little bit of a Mario Sue situation where he's like, but, you know, that wasn't correct. And I get it.
Right.
People deserve the benefit of the, like,
right.
Okay.
Well, it's like the Unabomber thing.
Yeah.
Where they had that guy, the profiler was like, wrote the book, and then, you know, or the screenplay or whatever. So he was, you know, he was making all the right decisions.
Yeah, sure. And okay, that's fine. But I just am disappointed. I don't know how they're going to get another 5 episodes out of this. And I mean, I don't want to find out, despite the fact that I was like, Leguizamo, okay. Like, these actors are not a joke. But then it's, I don't know, it's just this by numbers assembly that I'm not sure you can't learn just as much, much more quickly from either watching the documentary or like Googling it.
Yeah.
So
Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm out. I assume you're also.
It's a waste of talent and I assume a lot of money.
Yeah. And, you know, as interested as I am to see what Paramount and, you know, the former Spike are going to do in this genre, because I thought the Kalief Browder series was outstanding and not enough people watched it last year. This is not great. This is like 1980s quality, and that's not a compliment.
Agreed.
But speaking of going back in time, let's do so for a little palate cleanser with our pretty cold case section. We are looking at Marjo, the winner of the 1973 Best Documentary Oscar. I had heard of this. It had been sitting on my Netflix DVD list for a while, and I'd forgotten about why. Toby, can you give us a little background on why you thought this might be relevant?
Sure. And I guess it does sort of, it pushes sort of the true crime definition a little bit. Although there's, I think, you know, there's quite a bit of fraud, I guess I would say.
Well, and the on TV version, but I feel like occasionally this is on independent lens. You just have to set a wide DVR net. Yeah. But anyway,
So this guy, Marjo Gortner, Marjo is Mary and Joseph put together. He was a child preacher. Both his parents were, at least his dad was a preacher, and I think his mom did something religious. And so he started preaching at the age of 4. It sounded as though he had a horrendous upbringing where he was basically spent most of his time memorizing stuff from the Bible and, you know, the wedding ceremony, so he could do it off the top of his head. His mother used to, because she couldn't leave marks on him because he was constantly in public, would like smother him with a pillow.
She waterboarded him.
Yeah,
like,
she put him under a you know, the tap. So he, you know, he was sort of a little celebrity in the Pentecostal set, but was also, you know, essentially tortured by his parents to get him to memorize all this stuff so he could be like the youngest preacher in the world. So you get a little bit of that, and then you get him, you know, he must be in his late 20s maybe. But he essentially, he leaves, you know, he's never a believer basically. And he,
well, and I think he finally, like, none of that really pushed him to the edge. And you don't, I think you don't really see this or hear about this in the film, but what finally tore it is that he made like millions
by
the time he turned 18. And his father was like, buy Felicii and split with all of his money. And his mom's kind of like, okay, back to the drawing board. And Marjo's like, fuck this.
Right.
And just like left, like tied literally a bandana to a stick and, you know, was semi-homeless for a while. And then I think was like, you know, since it, you know, I don't believe this, but I can do it, I will return to the circuit. And then a lot of the film is him talking about that and how he likes to be on the stage and the singing and everything, but he's conflicted about some of it. He says on a waterbed while counting money.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's a total charlatan, and is self-aware. So anyway, I thought it was, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing to watch along with the David Koresh type stuff, because it is sort of a look at sort of the charismatic side of religion. And what makes it sort of doubly interesting in this case is that, you know, he doesn't believe a bit of it. You know, he likes like some general ideas, and he talks about like, if, you know, we could get everybody to like just put aside their hangups and like all get together and you know, be cool, that would be awesome. But instead I have to talk about like how the devil's going to get you if you don't do this, and Satan this, and then,
yeah, he's sort of like, if it were only the carrot, it would be fine. But then there's always this stick of fire and brimstone. Actually, that's in our first clip from this segment. Shall I play that? All right, here's clip 12.
I can't get up and say to them, okay, now listen, if you just believe this afternoon, I mean, it's all got to be done under the thing of Jesus, and which even that's okay. Like, you know, the Jesus thing I would leave, but they still, I've got to put in that thing, like, if you don't come down, you're going to go to hell, and you're going to burn, and you've got to go into the sin thing. It's the the way that I have to do it, if I could just do like the faith number and get up and say, okay, you know, everybody, let's really get loose this afternoon and get off and get rid of all of our hang-ups and have nice group therapy, that would be great. But you can't do it that way. It's got to all be done under this facade of holiness.
That sort of reminded me of, you know, the Simpsons episode where Bart makes the Flanders kids think that he's God.
I don't think I've seen that.
Like, okay, well, through the air vent, and then he's like, do you want an angry, you know, Old Testament God or a mellow, like, New Testament groovy God? And they're like, New Testament groovy God. Like, that just reminded me of that. That
No, he's like a total, like, sort of Jesus freak type. But, you know, but it's similar, I think, to Koresh in that, like, he gets the vernacular, you know. He knows that culture, and he is able to express things. And you just see like a lot of clips of this in a very sort of emotionally connecting way with his audience. And as you know, it's a real performance.
And that he knows, and how almost technical it is to sort of draw out the donations. Yeah. And you see a middle-aged woman. I mean, maybe like in the sort of Baptist adjacent styling of the early 70s, someone who was like 38 looked 50. Yep. That's certainly like, you look at pictures of my family and you're like, she was my age? Why? With the glasses. But there's I do have a strange respect for the ability to leverage this the same way that I like will have my palm read like at a bar, or I watch celebrity ghost hunters or whatever, and that psychic is sort of like, I'm seeing an M in a body of water, and I'm like, this is like, I'm just taking notes, like, okay, it's pretty easy to do a cold reading. Right. It's the same kind of thing. You're trying to part people from their money, and you know, as L. Ron Hubbard once said, best way to do that, start your own church. Yep. But I have to wonder, watching this alongside the Koresh properties, like if he had lived and like maybe he'd gone to jail and he'd been maybe medicated or got a little more distance on his life. And if he were sort of writing a, you know, a memoir or talking to the press about what it took to sort of build and maintain this faith in all senses of that word. But we don't have access to what he was really thinking. It's hard to say. But then Marjo is this very frank, you know, I don't believe any of this, but I'm outstanding at simulating it. So
yeah, really, you know, and he talks about how he, you know, he borrows like some of his moves from Mick Jagger. But some of these things, they really kind of come across as like a combination of sort of rock concert, like sort of getting people excited and emotional. And then there are these moments where it's really intensely up close and personal as people like kind of line up and he lays hands on them. Or people are like, you know, just on the ground shaking or speaking in tongues and stuff. I mean, it's coming from my perspective, it's very strange, but it's like a real kind of performance that is like affecting to these people on like a really like higher level than anything you really, like, I think you run into in sort of mainstream culture.
Well, and he talks a little bit about, like, he doesn't use this term, but that sort of, that idea of like the contagion of feeling in crowds and what turns like an angry crowd, like what is the tipping point in a crowd that is, you know, maybe thinking about rioting but not doing it, or maybe thinking about, you know, having these feelings. And like, having gone to girl school for a long time, like, there really is something to the idea that the group behaves as an individual that's different from its parts sometimes, part of that is that you're together all the time and 92% of you are on the same menstrual cycle. Don't wish to return to that period of my life, as it were. But in our last clip, Marjo is talking a little bit about how exactly this is executed and how he can read the crowd and figure out when it's going to tip towards people really buying in 100%. And it's interesting to me because I feel like part of his doing this documentary is like because he feels guilty, but I think part of him is also proud of how good he is at this in clip 13.
Once that you get one or two that really come off and say, yeah, I really felt it. You know, I had a bad back, I had a bad leg. Then there's a whole slew that say, oh, yeah, I feel better too. Because like 90% of it's psychosomatic.
I feel better.
Yeah.
That's right. Thank you, Jesus.
Thank you, Jesus.
Thank you, Jesus.
Oh, thank you, Jesus.
God is going to do something for you. Then I'll turn around to the crowd, and I'll say, everyone, do you believe it? And, you know, everyone, say yes, you know. I say, that's not enough. If there's no faith here tonight, I can't do anything. You've got to believe it. And I go, do you believe it? And then by this time, the crowds go, yes. And I'll say, sister, as I lay my hands on you, it's going to happen. By this time, you're just like this, you know, because I do a whole thing on you. Then, you know, I sort of like get down to now I'm going to pray the prayer and everyone bow your heads. And all of a sudden, they go, in the name of Jesus. And you know, by this time, that the shock doesn't get you. You know?
Thank you for the.
I mean, he's very charming,
yeah.
But it's really shitty what he's doing. Like, I mean, welcome to organized religion, I guess, and a question mark.
Yeah, well, the whole thing. I mean, and I think, you know, just looking at some of the stuff that was that the way it's presented and the way people talk about it is, you know, every place he goes, like he hooks up with these different preachers, like he'll be on their turf and they'll do something together. And it's all just about getting donations, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you hear this one guy who all he's basically talking about is how God made him rich. He's like, you know, I wanted a Ford and I went to the Ford dealer and I couldn't get it. And I went to the Chevy dealer. And I couldn't get it. And then I went to the Cadillac dealer and, you know, the Lord gave me the money and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so all these people are going crazy. And it's like,
it's basically The Secret, but at a tent revival.
Yeah.
Like, all right, I guess that works. And then the woman talking about, I couldn't quite follow the logic, but I guess that's the point, that she's like, you know, this has to be like, I don't want your donations that don't hurt
right.
you. These really need to be felt donations. It's me or the electric bill is what she's basically
yeah,
saying.
Like,
and that works. Like, okay.
Yeah, Jesus will like it better if you don't get your meds this month because you gave me money.
It's got to be a real sacrifice. She's like, I'm not talking about the normal tithing. More. Make it, you know, blood from a stone. But this, I mean, I see why it won Best Picture. Like, first of all, there are long periods where you're just like at services with Marjo and with these other people, sort of marinating in what it must have been like to be there so that you really get a sense of what he's talking about when he's explaining how he manipulates it. But it's, I don't know, it's really, they picked an excellent subject. Marjo is not afraid to just burn himself with this stuff. There's a long period of him like talking to this one long-haired sound guy and being like, you got to cut your hair. You can't smoke. Don't dog any chicks from the church. You'll blow up my spot.
Right.
It's really well done. And if you can find it, we'll link to some highlights in the show notes, but you can also rent it on Amazon. And
it's on Vimeo.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I watch it for free on Vimeo.
Yeah. Free's good. So we'll find a link for that and you can find it in the show notes. But I'm really glad that you brought that to my and our attention, especially since if we'd had to go out on this second Waco thing, I would have been a little bummed out. So I'm glad we got to bounce back.
It's definitely better than the second Waco thing.
Yeah. So en conclusion, A&E Waco Project and Marjo, thumbs up. Paramount's Waco, alas, don't bother. But if you listeners continue watching it and Leguizamo makes it worth our while to return, hit us up on Twitter @BlotterPresents or on Facebook, same place. Before we go, Toby, where can listeners find you and your work?
I'm on Twitter at TobyBallNH, and I am on the Crime Writers On podcast, which usually drops sometime on Friday, sometimes Friday evening. And I've got three sort of suspense crime novels, which you can find if you just go onto Amazon and put in my name.
Toby, thank you so much for coming back and for applying your master's level research to this little podcast. Really,
it was fun, as always.
Oh, thanks. Coming up on The Blotter Presents in future episodes, next time we'll be talking to returning guest Eve Beatty about Alcatraz and The Trade. No, we don't mean stickers. It's drugs, and it's on Showtime. And later in the month, the Tupac Biggie Smalls set of murders, Unfortunate Bookends, gets its own prestige series treatment, and we'll see how that goes. Guest TBD. This has been The Blotter Presents. You can find us, as I said, on Twitter and Facebook at Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Only had the Twitter address 10 years. You'd think I'd be able to get it out of my mouth by now. We'll talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.